Good evening. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing or a weekly lecture series, and tonight is the final lecture for fall 2017. And we are ending what has been a particularly good season on a very strong note. As you know, the esteemed and thoughtful artist team of Teresa Hubbard and Alexander Berschler are here to present their collaborative practice by focusing on specific, timely works of special relevance to this museum and beyond. We are fortunate to have found them available and willing, given the schedule they have been managing recently, and for that I am most appreciative. Teresa and Alexander have been working collaboratively in film, photography, and sculpture since 1990. Now living and working in both Austin and Berlin, they began collaborating as artists in residence at the Banff Center for the Arts, and later completed graduate degrees at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design in Halifax, Canada. This past April, they were each awarded an honorary doctorate of fine arts in recognition of their outstanding achievements to art and culture by the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design University. Represented by Tanya Benachter Gallery in New York, Laura Reynolds Gallery in Austin, and Gallery Vera Monroe in Hamburg, their exhibition record is extensive and impressive. But for the sake of time, I will just mention a few venues. They have shown in the 48th and the 57th Venice Biennales, the Tate Liverpool, Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago, the Reina Sofia Museum in Madrid, the Mori Museum Tokyo, the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Dublin, and of course the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. Many of you will recall Hubbard Berschler, No Room to Answer, an incredible survey of works spanning 1991 to 2008, curated by the Modern senior curator, Andrea Carnes. Most recently, Teresa Hubbard, Alexander Berschler Giant opened last summer and closed last month at the Blanton in Austin. And Hubbard Berschler are currently representing, until the end of November, Switzerland in the Swiss Pavilion at the 57th Venice Biennale in the exhibition Women of Venice, curated by Philip Kaiser. It is no surprise that with such an exhibition record, reviews and writing about the work is substantial. They have been regularly covered by the New York Times, Art Forum International, Art in America, Frieze, Parquet, and have been prominently featured in the PBS series Art 21. Their work is held in numerous public collections, including the Museum of Contemporary Art Los Angeles, Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden, the Kunsthaus Zurich, Kunstmuseum Basel, Museum of Fine Arts Houston, Yokohama Museum of Art Japan, and of course, the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. With the exhibition No Room to Answer, the Modern commissioned the brilliant Grand Paris, Texas in 2008, and it was actually commissioned in 2007, which is currently showing on the second floor along with later acquired series of photographs titled Holes from 1997. I hope you've had a chance to see that work. If you have not, I strongly recommend it. And set aside time to see the entire Grand Paris, Texas. It is worth the 58 minutes. Yes, your life will be better for it. Tonight, Hubbard Berschler are here to discuss the Modern's Grand Paris, Texas, described by Jeffrey Kastner for Art Forum as interweaving, quote, the physical and social space of a dead cinema, a forgotten song, and the inhabitants of a small town. So that makes you want to see it, doesn't it? In relation to their most recent works, Flora and Bust, featured in the Swiss Pavilion of the 57th Venice Biennale for the aforementioned exhibition, Women of Venice. which was lauded in Hyperallergic Review by Gregory Volk as, quote, "If I could, I would give this layered, richly human, and often tear-inducing work my own private golden lion," which, of course, is the ultimate award, inventing a new category, best and most meaningful work in the exhibition. Aren't we lucky? Please join me in welcoming Teresa Hubbard and Alexander Berschler.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much for this introduction. So, let's start here. Where are we? Oh, okay.
We're in Fort Worth.
So, yes, thank you very much for all of you for coming tonight. Thank you, everyone at the Modern. It's each time such an honor to come here. I enter the museum and I'm breathing. It's just an incredible place, and what a marvel you have here. You're really lucky. So right now upstairs, we won't talk too much about it, but so Grand Paris, Texas in 2008, it was part of this first survey exhibition at the Modern, curated by Andre Carnes, that traveled then to Germany and Switzerland afterwards. So Grand Paris, Texas was really a risk-taking moment for us. Looking back, we really understand this was sort of this pivotal moment where we started to be allowing ourselves to interview people and to have people in front of camera telling their own stories. That was not a first, but it was a first that we allowed ourselves to show it in public. So we started being interested in documentary mode much earlier when we started working together. But this was really the first moment when we could elaborate on this idea. And we refer often to this as a action research. It's sort of it was the first time where we would go out, we did not know what would happen, and we would let ourselves basically expose to the town of Paris, Texas, and spent there almost a year and researching. And as we would meet people, the research would take change, would take basically going left and right. And so that's what we refer as action research, and we continue doing this all the way to now. So a couple people like had a lot of questions when we showed Grand Paris, Texas the first time, but maybe now it makes much more sense. And so the other work that I have to talk about just briefly, so Holes, a series of five photographs, which is also in the collection, and shown upstairs. It's a work we're going now quickly back and then we go forward, and so it is a performative piece. It's performative photography. We were thinking about that time as the room as a camera, the camera as a room, and at that in this period of time we would use each other as performers, Teresa and me, and we would build these elaborate sets in front of the camera. We would build a picture, but we also would build a narrative or build a story. And once the story was built, we would take a picture. So what is important to maybe mention, to also make the reference back to Venice, so the Holes was actually shown in the 48th Venice Biennial, and that was curated by the Swiss curator Harald Seemann in the group exhibition, which was called Darpetuto. So this is the other one. There's five parts, and best is to look it upstairs. And now I'll be jumping to Horace. Teresa.
Okay. So we're going to jump back a little bit further and then we'll jump forward. So part of where Alexander and I started, we started as individually working artists, which when we talk about Flora, later on might make a connection, though we didn't make the connection immediately at the time. So we were individually working artists. We met, we became an artist couple, I guess you could say. And one of the things that I came from a background in writing, Alexander came from a very classical background, academic background in painting. And what we tried to do is we were getting to know each other as people. We tried to sort of find a language, tools, and tools to speak that language. And so a camera photography was one of the things that neither of us had much of a background in. So we began just by using each other in the work. He was a ready-made for me, and I'm him. And this is just a very small, fast photograph. It's one of the very first pieces we ever made when we were students in graduate school. It's from a series called A Natural History of Collaboration. And this one's called The Horse. And they're just these fast skits, almost, that we did in front of the camera in order to build a third being or a third place. So there's horse. Up here, there's on the right, universe, horse, and the last is magician. Yeah, so it's one of the things that was part and parcel and really helpful for us when we were in school is so the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. It's a heavy hitter in terms of its importance in the role of conceptual art. And when we were there, one of the things that we had to defend by making work is how interested we were in stories, storytelling, how stories are told, how do stories get built, and who are telling the stories. So that was something from the onset, from the beginning when we arrived. It's sort of something we wanted to do, but we had to really defend it when we were there. And it was really, really helpful. It really was important for us. NASCAD came from this incredible history when we were there of having artists such as Yvonne Rayner and Michael Snow, Dan Graham, Robert Frank, and women artists who've been huge models for me, Jenny Holtz, Lily Lozano. It was just a fantastic environment where they encouraged trial and error, and they left us alone. It was a right balance of giving us guidance and sort of kicking us in the ass when we needed it and letting us alone. So this is kind of where we started in terms of building pictures.
And the people that Teresa mentioned, that was the legacy we had to, I guess, start with. So all these people were mostly in the 70s and 80s when we went to college as
89, 90,
yes. And so the last piece, by going back, I think it's the last piece, and then we really talk about Venice, is from contestants in a birdhouse competition. So this is also a piece we actually showed at the Modern in this survey exhibition, No Room to Answer. This is in a different place in exhibition in Switzerland, and there's this striking resemblance, again, to Flora, this newest piece that we made this year, where we were interested in this photograph. In the background, it's actually an archival photograph that we found in a very small natural history museum in Western Canada. And in the foreground, you see these birdhouses that we reconstructed. And it's basically on the picture that we discovered, we found the photographer is unknown. And it was a very small photograph. So we, as part of the work, we enlarged it to life size, what we referred as life size to the figures. We're interested in how these young school children are holding up a village. It's sort of a creative competition. They compete. We know that we think the labels are sort of the prices, or their judges. In the background, it's their teachers. And so we were interested in these two, mostly in these two characters in the foreground. And their various bodies that we made out of these two characters, but the one piece that has left and is still existing is contestants in the birdhouse competition, where we reimagined and rebuilt basically all the birdhouses of these young that these young children would hold up.
I think one of the things that struck us, and that's often how we start with our works, is we were triggered by either a historic photograph or something we see in a film that's historic, that it just makes us want to look further. And what triggered me and us, I would say, it's a competition, right? And he's holding a mansion. And the way that he looks out at the photographer, a little cocky, at least he appears that way, a little self-assured. And next to him is a young woman, girl. She's holding sort of a mud hut with a crooked window, and she's looking down. It was ripe for projection. And again, because we're a couple, and it struck us as a very interesting juxtaposition, the way that he looks out and the way that she looks down.
Okay, which leads us to this summer. So the 57th Venice Biennial. So it was curated, as Terry already said, by Philip Kaiser. So it's the National Pavilion, so the Venice Biennial. And I can just go maybe one further. So this is the Swiss Pavilion in Venice, and the Venice Biennial is the oldest biennial that is still running. So it's up since 1895. It has an incredible history. Every 2 years, usually. There's a few exceptions over the more than 100 years now. And so there's these national pavilions, and there's a pavilion where there's a group exhibition. And so in this 2 years ago, 1.5 years ago, we were invited by Switzerland to represent Switzerland in an exhibition in the Swiss Pavilion, together with the American artist Carol Bouffe. And the concept or the background is this pavilion was rebuilt, so all these national pavilions have different architects that are kind of showcasing not only the artists but also architects, so the best artists. The best architect of the time would build the pavilion. So this pavilion changed location in Venice. It was in a different place, and in 1952, the Swiss government acquired this piece of land, and they invited Bruno Giacometti, which was a young architect at the time, Swiss architect, to build the Swiss Pavilion, to rebuild the Swiss Pavilion. So that's the building that he built. And Bruno Giacometti, you might, familiar with the name, Giacometti. So he was the youngest brother of Alberto Giacometti, which you might be much more familiar. So I just leave you three. So this is the entrance situation. So the title was called Women of Venice. And let's go back to 52 to kind of explain a little bit more about it. So this is actually, So this is in 2017. This is similar view in 1952. So in 1952, there was just a newly built pavilion by Bruno Giacometti. And this was actually the exhibition. It was built as a three-part space or institution. There's a sculpture yard, which you see in the foreground. There's sort of a middle section. You see three prints in the middle section through that doorway. So that was like a place for graphic arts. And in the very back, on the very right, you see where those chairs are and the paintings. That was a space for painting. So it was designed as a small institution, art exhibition gallery, with three different mediums. And the beginning, what was interesting, and I go one further. So let's go to Giacometti. So Alberto Giacometti, who most of you, I'm sure you're familiar with, he's probably the most famous 20th century sculptor. And he's Swiss. Most people think he's French or Spanish, but he's actually Swiss. And so in 1952, he was invited by the Swiss government to represent Switzerland. And because they thought, well, his youngest brother just built this wonderful pavilion, that would be the best time, you know, to showcase his work. And he politely rejects. He refuses. And the reason he's been invited several times, and the reason is because he really considered himself an international artist. He would live between Switzerland and Paris all the time. He would go back and forth. And he really, also very strategically, I think he was very smart. He knew that the best place for him to show would be the French Pavilion, because Paris at that point was the center of the art world in 1952. And so he waited, and in 1956 he was invited to the French Pavilion, and he showed a work which is called Women of Venice. And so that's also the title of this exhibition, which are nine figures very similar to this walking man, nine figures of women which are all standing. And so that's the title, Women of Venice. So the curator invited us. The particular point is that Alberto Giacometti, the most famous 20th century sculptor, most famous Swiss artist, has never shown in a Swiss pavilion. So that's, and so we were kind of like presented with the idea of absence, but the curator Philip Kaiser said, think of absence in larger terms, not just the absence of Alberto Giacometti, but what is absence meaning, what kind of absence. And so that started our search about a new work.
Okay. So maybe just we go back to the previous slide for a sec. So what the image on your left is, so this is actually the cover of one of the widest read biographies about Alberto Giacometti. It's a biography by a fellow called James Lord. It came out in 1985. And it's a very entertaining read. It's one of the first biographies about an artist where Lord really tried to get into the psychology of the artist. The book was hugely popular, nominated for a National Book Award, but it was equally criticized by art historians, including people like Lynn Cook and Lucy Lepard, criticized the book heavily for how he wrote about Giacometti and his work. The book, however, was never criticized about how James Lord writes about women, which I'll get to in a second.
Here. So, Therese and I, we have very different approaches to learning about Giacometti. Me growing up in Switzerland, Giacometti's everywhere. He's even on the 100 francs, Swiss francs bill, and he's really omnipresent. Or another example where
he's on coffee mugs.
He's on coffee mugs.
Tea towels. His work is everywhere in Switzerland. Everybody knows who he is.
And so going back to this book that we just showed before by James Lord, I think that I read this book as an art student. I don't know when you read it first.
I read it in this research.
I think you didn't read it. Yeah, so I reread it. So we both read about 70 books on Giacometti as we started this, because we, like, what is the basically what the way we work is we just try to accumulate as much as we can and to dig ourselves into the material.
And, I mean, for me, so I grew up in Australia and studied art in the U.S., and Giacometti, in my generation, he's on every slideshow, you know, in your art history classes. So, yes, I knew who he was, but he never really exactly triggered, never really resonated with me deeply. So for me, starting with the biography was a way to kind of get in more. And, of course, the more I learned about his work, the greater appreciation I had towards the incredible achievements that he made throughout his life. What struck me, us, when we read James Lord's biography is it's a photograph in his book. And the image legend says, Alberto Giacometti and Flora Mayo, with the bust she made of him, 1927. So I was immediately curious about Flora Mayo, never heard of her. We found out that both of them were students at a place called La Grande Chaumière. Around 1925 is when they met, and both were accepted into a class by a famous sculptor. His name was Antoine Bourdelle. So what struck us is in this moment, they are both young students in their 20s. In this moment, they are both having the same kind of potential to move forward with their dream of becoming artists. In this photograph, Alberto Giacometti is the model and Flora Mayo is the artist. That resonated. And then I read what James Lord writes about this very small, blurry, poor quality photograph. He writes, "Flora looks at her lover wistfully, as she had cause to do. She's attractive, but not beautiful, and there's something weak in her face. It must have been apparent even then that she was one of those destined to be destroyed by circumstances." And that sent us down the rabbit hole of it was so sexist and so blatantly projection that we wanted to find out what happened to Flora Mayo. Who was she? And that's what started our journey.
So why did we know Flora Mayo? Or why did we know Flora Mayo? So Flora Mayo, the name comes up only in context from Giacometti, Alberto Giacometti. So the fascinating thing is Alberto makes a bust of her in 1926. And so this bust is called Tête de Femme, Head of a Woman, Flora Mayo. And so it's a year before she makes a bust of him. And, of course, this bust survives, and this bust is in the collection of the Annette and Alberto Giacometti Foundation in Paris. And that's the only reason why this name is familiar or might be familiar or people have heard about it. And not much else is known about Flora. So we did all the research because we really started getting interested in, so is this woman. So it was known that she was wealthy. She grew up in Denver, Colorado. She was in an unhappy marriage. She was forced into a marriage. She would leave that marriage. She would go to New York and eventually to Paris. And we know, I think from the book from Lord, we know that she apparently, by 1933, destroys all her work and goes back to the U.S. That's all we know about Flora Mayo. And what's striking is, I read this book, at least twice. I read it probably more than that. But when I was in my 20s in Switzerland, this story was not of interest. I couldn't place it. And when I was rereading it, it was very fascinating because I suddenly understood much more like where Colorado is in relation to Texas. I know much more about the history. Suddenly a woman from Denver became really interesting. Like I was really wondering how would she, you know, end up in Paris in 1926? What's her story? And how was she able to do this? And so, of course, the second time I read the story, it really struck me, and I was immediately attracted to trying to find out more about what happened to Flora Mayo. And so we would read all the books possible and trying to find out who else has written about Flora Mayo.
And what we found is that often it was like cut and paste. Flora, you know, she's mentioned as a complete footnote or just a tiny little bit, but basically what little was known is just repeated.
So everything goes back to this one biography written by James Lord.
Yeah.
And that's the only place where really is the source, where she's mentioned as a source. So the first thing that we did, which goes back maybe to the birdhouse, we tried to reimagine the sculpture. We knew, or we assumed, the sculpture would no longer exist. We tried to find it. It doesn't exist. We can say that for sure. And so the first step was just trying to imagine, like, how large was this piece and trying to rebuild the piece. So we did these studies from a photograph, basically building from a photograph, trying to rebuild the sculpture that Flora Mayer made in 1927. And so we would use photographs of the period because we had only one view of Alberto, one view of this bust. And so in order to understand what actually the bust looked like in three dimensions, we had to look at Alberto Giacometti. And the great thing is that Alberto Giacometti is one of the artists who really knew how to use photography. And so he was actually, he liked to pose, and he was, he's very well represented in photography, and he appreciated the new medium of photography because he could showcase himself. And so there are different historic photographs. different photographs from where the older ones are from the one Man Ray, Wafar, and the newest one, the oldest one is the one up top, which is actually, photography is not known. But he's in the age 26 to 32. That's all the photographs we used. And so we tried to rebuild from the bust, from this original photograph, and from pictures of Alberto Giacometti. We tried to build this three-dimensional object. This goes through different stages. We would eventually cast it. We would cast it in brass because at the time brass was cheaper than bronze. And most artists at the period would use brass unless they were really wealthy. And so we would cast a Flora's, we reconstruct Flora's sculpture. And so this leads us to the pavilion. So in the place where this was designed by Bruno Giacometti, that's the graphic cabinet, we would show this photograph, this reproduction of this photograph, and a reconstruction of Flora Mayer's bust. So here's another close-up of what it looks like.
And the piece is called Bust. Bust is in bust. Bust is in sculptural high art bust. Bust is in being broke. Bust is in being broken. And this is the title, actually, of the piece.
It's a very long title.
Bust, 2017. Flora Mayer and Alberto Giacometti with the bust she made of him circa 1927. Photographer unknown. Original photograph belonging to Flora Mayer kept under her mattress, lost. Film negative, missing. Reproduction from only known duplicate print, archive of Fotostiftung Schweiz, Winterthur. Original clay bust portrait of Alberto Giacometti by Flora Mayer, lost. Reconstructed and cast in brass. So there was a lot of writing about this project that we did in Venice, and Claire Walsh, who's a critic and curator from the Scottish National Gallery, I loved what she wrote. She says, "The caption next to the photograph and sculpture reads like a list of apologies."
So... This was all very easy, and
no, it wasn't.
Of course it wasn't. Of course it wasn't. So as we keep researching, so we keep reading, we start working, we start planning, we come across these articles. The first article was written in a book, The Women of Giacometti, in 2005, and it was actually co-published with the Nasher and Pace Wildenstein Gallery. So in 2005, we come across this very fascinating article about Flora Mayer, somebody else who writes about Flora Mayer, actually the director, the former director of the Annette and Alberto Giacometti Foundation in Paris. At that time, it was co-published with them. And so what is in the article is really fascinating but devastating for us.
It was a major stumbling block.
We fell out of everything. We're in the midst of working on the story of Alberto, of Flora Mayer. And so what these articles say, and there are several of them, it basically says that the woman on the right in this black and white, in this one photograph, is actually not Flora Mayer. The woman is Margaret Cossacano, And so Margaret Costakino is actually this woman on the right, on the left, sorry. And this is Margaret Costakino, and she is actually also a well-off young woman studying at the same time in Paris at the Grand Chaumière. And so this woman, this writer, basically comes to conclusion that because of the likeness, because of the time, etc., this is not Flora Mayo, this is Margaret Costakino. So we have a big problem. A big, big problem. Because we want to tell the story of Flora Mayo, the only photograph that exists is not Flora Mayo. And so what we do is we basically contact this writer and we ask her if he could try to find out, like, how did she do her research? Maybe we come across new clues and maybe there's something else there that we can save our piece.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes.
Can you go back a couple of slides so we see the photograph again?
Which one?
The close-up. Sorry.
Which one? This one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Didn't do that very elegantly.
Okay. Because if she's not Flora Mayo, this artwork has not been made by her either.
And we just made a bust, a reconstruction of the work by Flora Mayo.
The writing, not only, in a way, Flora Mayo, whoever she was, enters art history and is ditched the first time. And then she's ditched the second time because she's not even herself. And the artwork's not even hers. So that is a stumbling block, was devastating but thrilling. That led us to a different place.
So we retraced, we tried to find every source that this writer has used, and we come across other sources that this writer might not have seen. So in 26, 25, 26, in the Philadelphia Ledger and in the New York Times, there's this photograph published with different titles, different legends. And so this one is from the Philadelphia Ledger, and it basically says a famous French sculptor with his American pupils, and Antoine Bourdel, which is the one in the middle, the only man clearly identifiable with all these different women. And actually, if you look, I don't know if you can read it, around him are Mrs. Florida Mayo Denver, Miss Helen Rand, etc., etc. Then there's also Miss Flora MacDonald, and it's really confusing. And then another woman from Denver. But so Florida Mayo, well, it could be Flora Mayo. But where are these people? Around him doesn't mean anything. So the writer has made the conclusion, because she was once described in a letter by somebody else as a pretty blonde. So the writer assumed, well, the pretty blonde must be next to the master, to their master, Antoine Bourdel. So her conclusion was that Flora Mayo is this blonde on the left of Bourdel.
Yeah, left.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And basically, based on that, and based on other information she collected, she made the assumption that Flora is not on this other picture, and that is actually Margaret Costakino. So the most amazing thing about this photograph, and we only learned this later, is that, well, maybe Flora is in this picture. Well, there's a Florida Mayo. Well, there was a typo. And Flora actually is in the picture. And more, I mean, so let's go, if we can go back to this. Yes, so Flora is actually right here at the edge of the frame. She's the blonde standing, looking straight into the camera below that man. And so what is really amazing to us, and we only discovered this quite a while later, after we researched this photograph extensively, thinking about which one could be Flora, with the help of another person, we were able to identify her. So she stands at the edge of the frame. She's not in the center, and this was basically, it was a gift. This photograph is a gift. So how do we know that this is flora. And so what James Lord has not written in his book is that Flora had two children. One child she has in her first marriage, and she's unhappy in the marriage. She leaves the marriage. She leaves her daughter behind. She will never see her daughter again in her life. She goes to New York, then goes to Paris. She will never be able to see her daughter because her husband and her father prevents her from seeing her daughter again. But she has a second son. So in 1935, second child. And in 1935, when she's back in Denver, she has David, and nobody knew that David existed. So this is David Mayo, and more amazing is we found out Joan, the first child of Flora, we found out there was Joan. By the time we found out where Joan could be, we realized that Joan died about 7 years ago, and so we didn't know that David existed, and eventually we figured out there's another child, and so David actually lived, he's still alive, and he lives in outside of Los Angeles.
And so I phoned him up. And
well, it took a while to find his phone number, but yes.
Yeah. Flora had him when she was a single mum. She returned to the States destitute after the Great Depression. And in order that she could find jobs and get housing, it was really difficult in records to find out if she was with a companion or if this was her child. And eventually it was Alex who made the crucial link, and he passed me the phone to contact him. And it was really an intense moment of discovery on many levels. Also because David, he's not in the art world. He lives outside of Los Angeles. And only 3 years ago did he realize that there was this past to his mum that he never knew about. His wife said, you know, Dave, you're getting up there in years. You should really find out a little bit more about your family. Let's Google your mother. And so through Google, they found out that she had this connection to this artist. And that was how we started knowing David. So we made several trips to visit David, and we talked a lot on the phone. And when we finally went out to his place, he let us rummage around in his garage, and he has these boxes of stuff, you know, these photographs. And these are photographs that no one in the art world has ever seen before. These are photographs of Alberto Giacometti as a young man with his mum. And David kept the photographs because of his mother, not because of this guy. In fact, to us, he said, yeah, like I always wondered who the guy with the funny hair was. I remember when we were making these discoveries in the garage, we would call experts in the Giacometti world asking, we think we found photographs, and we're told, no, we know everything already about him, and we already have the photographs, and we sent some iPhone shots, and then people started calling us back.
So the last part was, and this goes maybe all the way back to Halls again, so our interest in building a story. So we did a lot of research in the Brudel archives in Paris because we wanted to rebuild the studio that Flora actually made this bust. And so based on archives, there's no photographs of her studio. There's no photographs of her work at all. But based on this archive, we looked at different women artists' studios in the 20s in Paris, and so we rebuilt her studio. That was the last part of Flora. This is actually during the filming. You see the film track on the floor. And this is our actress, Julia Zong, a German actress, which plays our Flora. And so she's now working in the studio, 1927, and we placed the story in of Flora, her story, in early February 1927, when she would work on this bus for a couple weeks, and Alberta would occasionally come to her studio, and they would he would model for her. And so this is actually the installation of the piece. Mm-hmm. So this is in the large. This is in the large room, which originally was designed to be the room for painting in the Swiss Pavilion. So that was a big challenge because the absence of light and the presence of light. So a painting room usually has the perfect daylight, and a video room needs the complete absence of light. So
you walk from the connecting room where that gentleman is coming in. That's the room leading into where Bust is. And Flora, it's two sides, two completely different sides of the same story. One side is Flora's side and one side is David's side. And we structured it so that we wanted it to be on almost two cinemas in one. We wanted them to collapse the two cinemas into one space. So all of the sound comes from inside the screen itself. And the biggest challenge was, how do we tell two completely different stories sharing the same soundtrack? And so there are moments where one sound bleeds to the neck, to the other side, but we really wanted this conversation, a sort of impossible conversation between a mother and son that didn't talk about a lot of stuff. And this was a way to have the space and their stories kind of intertwine, going back and forth. So this is the other side, which is David's side.
And so I think we have a clip, and we're going to show, I think, two times, maybe 3 minutes of the very beginning. And so it's the beginning, but it's on two different sides. I think you get a little bit of idea.
Each side's 30 minutes, and...
Right.
A lot of people, we thought that people would be walking back and forth, but what was surprising is that people would sit and stay on one side, and then they would
sit for 30 minutes,
and they would look at the other side
for 30 minutes. So, can we turn the lights off?
Headstrong, impulsive, and romantic, and in many ways a bit of a savage. There are reasons for that. There must have been something wrong with me, because Alberto Giacometti wasn't interested in regular girls. Sat for Alberto in his studio. When I was about to leave, I was standing, looking at the head he was making of me. We were both silent. I was silent because he had given me the impression that he was not yet satisfied with his work. and that he wanted me to return and sit for him again. But he never said anything more about it. I heard that Alberto had also painted the head and carved into my face using his pocket knife. Together to a party. There were a lot of people there, and in particular, there was one girl whom I thought was very attractive. I mentioned this to Alberto on the way home in a taxi. And he said, "There are a lot of girls like that, but only one Flora."
So this is very unelegant, but you just noticed the doors. So when you watch the other side, remember this moment where we hit the car doors. So we want to watch the other side again, from the beginning. So these two sides play at the same time. Can we turn the lights down again? So let's hope that it is the other side. Yes.
Do you know that I'm supposed to have a Russian soul? I was told I could have stepped out of the cherry orchard. Headstrong, impulsive, and romantic. And in many ways, a bit of a savage. There are reasons for that. Been something wrong with me, because Alberto Giacometti wasn't interested in regular girls. For Alberto in his studio, when I was about to leave, I was standing looking at the head he was making of me. We were both silent. I was silent because he had given me the impression that he was not yet satisfied with his work, and that he wanted me to return and sit for him again. But he never said anything more about it. I heard that Alberto had also painted the head and carved into my face using his pocket knife. Yeah. One evening we went together to a party. There were a lot of people there, and in particular, there was one girl whom I thought was very attractive. I mentioned this to Alberto on the way home in a taxi. And he said, "There are a lot of girls like that, but only one Flora."
No one has ever contacted me wanting to know about my mother, Flora, ever. My mother lived basically a very quiet and unnoticed life. It was a surprise out of the blue. It was totally unexpected. I can't express how much of a I was delighted to see that my mother would get some recognition. She had a hard life.
I had never known anyone like Alberto, and he had never known anyone like me. I told him that I wanted to make one beautiful thing, and he said, "Me too." Alberto recognized something in me, which I only very rarely recognized in myself.
My name is David Mayo. I am the only surviving child of Flora Lewis Mayo. I am 81 years old.
Okay. So, can turn the light back. Oops, I don't want to go there. There we go. So, I think it's a great introduction to do the piece. So, it is 30 minutes each side, and unfortunately, it's 8 o'clock. And the last thing I have to say, Teresa just mentioned it. So on the picture, what we found out that actually it is Flora Mayo. And we did find a duplicate of the print in this museum, in this archive in Switzerland. And when we contacted the people, we said we would like the print that depicts Flora Mayo. The people asked us, "Do you mean the print that depicts Margaret Cosse-Canoe?" And we said, "No, it's the print that is Flora Mayo." And so in the meantime, the archive has changed the name again. It is Flora Mayo, and we have now many pictures of her, including this passport from 1924 or 3. And there's a lot of material that we found in the trunk that David never knew he had. So this is one of them.
I think, what's fascinating about this action research, and yes, sometimes it is really easy, and sometimes the answers are not. But on a hike with some women that I walk with, they said, "God, Teresa, it's so easy. She just dyed her hair." You know, there's mentions of her as being a pretty blonde, but in the photograph, her hair is quite dark. And when we found through David other photographs of Flora, like many women do, she just changed her hair color and hairstyle. And it was really that rather simple. I think one last comment is to kind of circle back to this idea of absence. So finding Flora and committing to tell her story, or tell a part of her story, or at the very least what we try to do is we try to show the complexity of what a person is. She struggled a lot in her life Later on, she made her living as she worked in a factory, and her last job, she was a janitor. And some people have asked, well, was she a good artist? The question doesn't interest me in the least. She might have failed as an artist, but she tried to be a good mother. And the piece is about, especially during this generation, showing the complexity of having to make difficult choices in a set of very limited choices. So we did a talk with the director of the Tate Modern, Frances Morris, and she's a fan of the piece, which is amazing for us, and she said, you know, it's Alberto Giacometti's Beside the Point. She said it makes me think of my history and my family and my mother, and that was sort of the field that we want this work to operate in. So when we think about absence, we think about all of the generations of women who have never even thought about an opportunity of showing their artwork in the Swiss Pavilion.
And so just very quickly, so what happened since we discovered this story, so this is the Giacometti exhibition this year at the Tate Modern, and when you look very careful, it's a wonderful room. These are all portraits Giacometti made in his lifetime. And if you look really carefully, Flora Mayer is in the center of Giacometti's universe. So it's quite amazing. This sculpture was never shown before. So this was the first time it was in Zurich, and we filmed David in Zurich, and a year later it came to Tate, and now it's probably going to be booked in the next 10 years in exhibition. So Flora becomes the center. And so the most amazing thing is when you look at the two photographs, there's an incredible likeness, and I think there will be a lot of research about that. Now we know what this woman actually looked like when Alberta made that sculpture of her. It's quite an amazing sculpture. It's very flat. It's beautiful, and it's just very, very flat. And Alberta, at the time, he moved towards abstraction, from figurative sculpture to abstraction. It's a very important moment in his period. And I think that's it.
Yeah. Thanks. So we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are the films available online, or are they on the Modern website? The full 30 minutes?
Oh, unfortunately.
It'll take a while, but maybe the Modern.
You get my vote.
No, they're not available online.
We do think about it as a sculpture. So we think about these two sides as... We can show a tiny little bit here in a lecture setting, but we really want it to be a piece that is filling a space, filling a room with these two different sides happening at the same time.
The experience should be really, so there's 12 sources of sound, so it really should be seen as this dual, this collapse. We think of a collapse, two cinemas collapse, so this idea should be maintained. Yes.
You talk, just, I know we don't have much time, but I'm so amazed at the time frame I'm imagining you had to make this. And from, to my mind, you had the research, the action research, you had the logistics, you had to develop the story, and then there's the poetry of it, the way it's shot, what you imagined the absence to be. Like, what was your time frame?
So we started the work, we had a long discussion with Philip, the curator, like maybe over half a year, of what would we do if we would be invited.
Uh-huh. I love those conversations.
And with several different locations also, it was the discussion, because Switzerland used to have a second location, which was a church, also in Venice. So we talked about locations. It was a long, long discussion. And we had no idea what we would do. And he developed his concept. And he only hinted that there's sort of his interest in Giacometti. So when he finally invited us, he said, I invite you to this, and this is my curatorial concept. And so we were very excited, but we really had no idea what we would discover. And so we just cancelled everything else, and we worked until, I think, 2 days before the opening, all the way
well,
to
it was,
Venice.
I mean, you may or may not know this, Andrea, but, you know, when we were commissioned to do a new piece here for the Modern, and we had a hunch, you know, we walked into the movie theatre in Paris, and this dead theatre was swarming with pigeons and rats and we thought, oh my God, there we have to make a piece here. We don't know what it's going to be, what shape it will take, but we have to spend more time with this place. And it was similar in that once we had the trust of the person, the curator in this sense, in that case Andrea or in Venice Philip, we drop everything, and then it just right. You go on this.
And the story. I mean, we only discovered David. I mean, I think the first time we had contact with David was September, once we knew that he existed. I mean, we packed everything. We at that time we're living in Berlin, so we flew to LA and got a crew together. We knew we had to. The story was just too amazing. So, yeah.
So you didn't sleep for a year, yeah. A year and a half?
I slept a little bit.
No, but it's we put the finishing touches of the Modern 2 days before. I mean, when we drove
here, I mean, yeah. Yeah. So it was similar.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a It's a journey, and I think it's just the way we work that if we wouldn't have that, the deadline is often what forces you to like let it go.
Maybe one more question. Yes.
About a million, but first of all, I had the opportunity to see it in person, and it was just one of the most moving art experiences I've had in a really long time. But
thank
I'm wondering.
You.
Did David have the opportunity to see it? And did you purposefully leave it ambiguous, and is it just me, the possibility that David was Giacometti's own son?
So David had the opportunity, so we invited him to come to Venice. I was with him maybe a month ago. So I wanted that he never seen the piece. And the way we work, we don't share that. I mean, we try to have the trust, but then we really have to work on by ourselves and not be influenced by our subject. And so it was really important to make that clear. And so David saw it the first time. We both wanted that. He sees it in Venice the way it's intended. And it was very moving. People would come up to him, and we would watch it over. We went 2 days, and we would watch it a couple times. He insisted he wanted to watch it again. And people would come up to him and thank him. They would recognize him, thank him for the story he told us. And people had no idea who I was. We were just standing next to David. So
I think someone even told you to, like, get out of the way because they were trying to see the piece.
Two people told me actually get out of the way because they couldn't see the piece. But so that was nice. The other thing about that he's the son, So Flora leaves in 33 and David comes into place in 35. I think we played with some sort of a suspense. I think everybody would like to wishes that that would be the case, but we disclose it in the film. Eventually you can add it up. Like Flora says when she leaves Paris and David says when he's coming into the world. But, I mean, the story about Flora is amazing. So David doesn't know his father, which is a complete different story. And, I mean, the tragedy is sort of the very beginning. So the irony, so her last apartment was called the Versailles, which you saw the sign. It's actually in downtown Los Angeles. And it was a time of social housing, one-bedroom apartment. And so she dies very poor. And she's not able to really reconnect with her artwork, and she never has money again. But she never complained. She was apparently just doing what she had to do. And David had to give up a lot for her. So there was just this really tight relationship. And he was very happy that I think this is happening. He's very excited about it, that he can tell this story.
Flora's voice in the film is a composite of letters that she wrote looking back on that period, things that she never told David about. So I think it's... I don't know, it was really important for us to bring David to Venice and have him experience the work as we intended. It would have been a lot cheaper and easier just to send him, you know, so he could watch it on the computer. But it was the same importance that we wanted at the end of the film, for those of you that haven't seen it, on David's side. He makes this journey to Zurich,
Switzerland.
Yeah, and he's not a museum guy. He's only been in two museums his whole life, and they were not art museums. And we wanted him to see the head of his mother on view, because he had thought all this time that his mother had lived this life, and he didn't know so much about her past. Maybe she didn't tell him because she didn't want him to know how much she'd given up to have him. But we wanted also, because he's at the end of his life now, in a sense, for him to sort of see that actually, you know, his mom is out there, and she's been. She's been out there with this piece, and
it was amazing. Just somebody emailed from the national, like from the Smithsonian or the National Library, and they contacted us. They want to put her in a database, so they contact us. Do we know when she was born? Do we know when she died? And so it's amazing. I mean, people really kind of do justice now to her, late, but nevertheless.
Perspective of seeing the work that you rescued a life. I mean, I'm not making light of the life that she actually lived, but from what we're seeing, it feels like you rescued, you retrieved a life with this piece. It's so inspiring. And when I think about that, I think about Grand Paris, Texas, and there's a little element of that in that piece as well.
I think with Gran, well, I think it's a thread running through all of the pieces. We're interested in small stories. We're interested in what happens at the edge of the frame. We're interested in people who don't make it into the books. You know, we're interested in that, for sure. We're interested in that. And we're interested in Flora, I don't know, because we're artists. We know, and anyone that's in the room that is an artist, you know how close you are to success and failure. So close you are to thinking, I can't live my life without doing this thing, but yet you hate it at the same time, and you wish to God you could find something else, some other way out. That we wanted, especially with this idea of success and failure, and that presence and absence, that a lot of that would come to the surface in terms of how history gets made. It's not in any way to diminish Giacometti's amazing accomplishments, but they did not start off in the same place.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.